Welcome everyone to the V Book Club podcast. This is a new podcast from the makers of V Magazine and V Speaks podcast. I'm Jordan Staggs, the editor of V, and I'm your host for this. And we are here today with David Yarrow. He's a very prolific fine art photographer who was actually the cover artist for our July issue. So welcome, David. Thank you for being here.
It's good to be here, virtually.
Yes. And you're calling, you're in from Los Angeles, but you've been traveling all over this week. So tell us a little about what you've been doing.
We were in Oslo last week for our biannual show in Norway. And it was, particularly relevant last week in that we unveiled a picture we took of Erling Haaland, who is probably the world's most relevant sportsman right now, in that he's a footballer and achieving extraordinary feats for his club. So that was unveiled in his home country, got a lot of press. And then we filmed on Wall Street in New York on Sunday last week, and then we arrived in LA where we are now, and we open our show in Los Angeles tonight. And then we open in Denver tomorrow night, and then we open in Charlotte next week. So it's kind of full.
Yeah. Very busy week. So the sports, that's how you got into photography in the first place, right?
Yeah. Well, I was never good enough to play sport professionally. So I thought the second best option would be to photograph it, and it would give me access to enjoy watching sport some of the time, most of the time photographing it, and occasionally being paid. So as a young kid, it was serendipitous, and it worked for me.
So what's one of the highlight moments that you can remember from some of those early sporting events that you photographed?
There were a lot of low-light moments, and that's in a way, but I think certainly taking the picture of Diego Maradona in the World Cup final in Mexico in 86, and it's probably the third biggest grossing sports picture of all time now, after pictures of Muhammad Ali. I wasn't a very good photographer, I must admit. I just got lucky with that one particular moment.
Well, I think there was something to it for sure. And you've obviously evolved a lot since then, going into more wildlife photography, photographing models and setting up different campaigns for huge brands around the world. How does it evolve into that?
Well, I think each person's personal journey is going to be different. I think mine would be characterized by a determination to get better, to stay relevant. I still have that same determination. Mm-hmm. 37 years after I took that picture, to be very tough on yourself, to really address what an audience wants rather than to give them what you can. And I think there's a big distinction between those two things. I think that I was guilty of, in my earlier part of my career, just photographing what interested me rather than addressing whether it was commercial. Mm-hmm. I think still you could say that is true of the industry as well. And this is a time where everyone is a photographer. So we are the most content-spoilt generation that's ever lived.
Right.
And I think there has to be an examination of what do people want. And I'm very unapologetic about addressing that and trying to give people what they want. Because if you don't, you don't really have a business. You don't really have a purpose. It can be a passion, hobby, but not a business.
Mm-hmm. So, and you're also all about storytelling with every shot. So how do you build those stories as you go?
Well, I think if you take each assignment, I think you ring fence each assignment, and it's a bit like being a film director. You have an idea, and it takes an idea a long time for a good idea to be, for an idea to become a good idea. As Steven Spielberg said, most ideas start off as bad ideas. That's why it takes so long to actually produce the final product. Mm-hmm. I think the necessity to iterate and iterate and iterate, spinball ideas, try and be greedy visually, And because you're trying to tell a story in 250th of a second, whereas most people, when they tell a story at dinner or tell a story in a movie, they take either 3 or 4 minutes to tell the story at dinner or 2 hours to tell it in a movie. So to try and tell a story in 250th of a second requires a different toolkit. I think we get better at it. We learn how to get it right by getting it wrong quite often. And last week, 2 weeks ago, we're filming in West Texas, and we were doing a kind of early days of the oil exploration story, partly because this film, Killer of the Flower Moon, is coming out in 3 weeks' time, and it's obviously a very big film release from Martin Scorsese, and it's going to be topical, and we thought that it would be a good time to tell an oil series story from the early 1900s. But from the planning into that shoot, probably started about 6 weeks before we shot, and we built a site, built a derrick. And these are not small exercises. I think that one day cost us about $180,000. Wow. So if you're throwing $180,000 at one day and you get nothing, you've just lost $180,000. Right. So it's certainly focused on mine.
Yeah, and a day and everyone's time who was there. So
yeah.
I know you're very inspired by film. You mentioned Scorsese and Taylor Sheridan before. What is it about these stories that, you know, you see and then you think, I want to do something related to that or recreate some of these iconic scenes?
I don't think we necessarily recreate scenes. I think that would be a little bit spank of a little bit of plagiarism. And the key to art is authenticity. I think we can borrow from the vibe of the movie and we do it in a way that's cheeky, that is an element of parody. We're not trying to rewrite history, and we're not trying to be too earnest, and we're not trying to preach. I think we're more trying to have fun and engage by having fun. Tarantino once said that he's never had an original idea in his life. And he was meaning that. He wasn't trying to be sarcastic. What he's probably saying is that just walking down the street, he might see something that prompts him creatively. And that's the way we are. There are things that I see every day that I clock. And maybe it's consciously or subconsciously, we'll bring that back into play when I feel as if I need it. I think it's a bit like being a chef. If you are a good chef, you'll have near wherever you're making your food, you'll have a ton of herbs and spices. And quite often you'll never use those spices, but there'll be times when you decide it is time to throw it in. And I think that's a little bit about how we play it.
That makes sense. So working with different models and these celebrities that you've met along the way, how do you deal with them, and how do they collaborate with you on the shot?
Well, if fame is an amplifier, if someone is not necessarily the nicest people and they become famous, I think it's probably more likely that they'll continue to not be very nice. If someone is a nice person and they become famous, they will probably continue to be even nicer. I want to work with people that are nice, have good energy, that are collaborative. And the ones that we work with that we don't find those traits, it's probably a very short collaboration. But with some of the sports stars that we've worked with some of the well-known women, like, for instance, Cindy Crawford, the relationship has such longevity and depth that we know each other very well. And what I would never want to do is let these people down. They're quite often giving their time for free. And nothing worse than when, for instance, you give your time for free or I give my time for free, that it turns into being a miserable experience. So we try and be at the top of our game and respect them and their time, show manners, make sure everything works with almost military precision, and hopefully at the end of the day come out with something that's enjoyable and different.
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of your shots are so carefully curated. You've got a lot going on in the background. You've got multiple people, animals. Like, how do you set that up beforehand to get that shot?
I think you flatter us, because I think whilst quite a bit of it is meticulously planned and there's a kind of surgeon's eye to detail in the composition, when we actually go live, so many things can go wrong. Mm-hmm. But all you need is one glimpse, one fraction of a second when it does go right. And then you've got your moment. I think that we're always borrowing from our past experiences. Photography is something that you should get better at as you get older, not just because maybe your emotional intelligence evolves, but also because it's an aggregation of all the mistakes you've made. And everyone makes mistakes. You just perhaps don't want to make the same mistake time and time again. That's a little bit. Yeah. But we're very conscious visually of the backdrops that we use. It'd be very rare that we take a picture where we haven't given an intense amount of thought as to what's going on in that final layer of the image. And America's great perspective because the scenery quite often has such grandeur that it becomes a character in itself.
Mm-hmm. I know, going back to, this is the book club podcast, so obviously we want to talk about your books, and you just had your fifth one come out last year called Storytelling. Tell us a little about curating that and the different sections that are in it. How did you decide what was going to make it into the book?
If you allow me to just preface this by saying that books, unless you write about wizards or Harry Potter or kinky sex or werewolves, or unless you're a celeb and you write an autobiography, there's no money in books. Books are, by and large, a way to try and make money. For us, they're like a business card. Mm-hmm. The average hardback coffee table book that's brought out every year around the world, whether they're in Mandarin or whether they're in Spanish or whether they're in English, sells 3,500 copies. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're an author for one of those books, and let's imagine that these books are selling for $30. Let's imagine it's selling for $30. With your royalties being at 12% or 11%, you put all this effort into making a book, and your income from that book is going to be $10,000. Mm-hmm. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I don't think that's enough to live on for a year. So what I think you have to do with a book is make it a labor of love, make it beautiful. For a hardback book. Mm-hmm. And remember that you're not doing this for financial gain. If you make financial gain from it, you're lucky. Right. Of course, there are exceptions to that rule. J.K. Rowling's done very well writing books. That's very good. So what we wanted to do was put it into chapters and make sure those chapters had a cohesion to it. I think books or pictures without context can leave the reader in a vacuum. And the one thing that I believe in very strongly in our books is that I must couple the pictures with words. If you put the words immediately after the picture, it can be lacking in cohesion. And from a design perspective, Rizzoli, the publishers, are very keen that we did write, but a lot of the writing comes right at the end. Mm-hmm. So in our book, yeah, there's 126 pictures, but there are 60,000 words, right, which is quite a lot of writing. And I think if it wasn't for those words, the book would be very average. And no one in your book club would have a thing to read. They just have, because by and large, I think book clubs, people read rather than look at things. Mm-hmm. I didn't want a picture book.
No, well, it's not, and it is a hefty book.
Yep.
It is a big one. I ordered three and then wasn't sure why the Amazon or, you know, whoever delivered it had left it in front of the house instead of by the door, which is on the side. And I picked up the box and I was like, I know why.
It's yeah, heavy. Exactly.
But it's beautiful. It is a beautiful book. And it's very diverse. So you have a lot of, you know, the different chapters that you were talking about. There's wildlife, there's the ski lodge, the vintage cars. So what does each chapter kind of represent?
I think each chapter just represents a different commercial and creative undertaking. I don't necessarily need there to be a unity between the chapters. The only thing that unites them is that the pictures were taken by me. I struggle with this idea that photographers should be categorized in a sort of neat pigeonhole. Like, oh, he's a sports photographer. He's a wildlife photographer. He's a photojournalist. He's a wedding photographer. I'm just a photographer. And I find that the concept that what you're photographing should bend back and affect your ability to photograph it, I don't think that stands up to close intellectual scrutiny. The idea that if on Monday you're photographing your best friend and then on Tuesday you're photographing a giraffe, people would say, my goodness, what's your... You must have been very, very difficult to go and photograph a giraffe because you normally do people. And you go, well, actually, I just do what photograph whatever in front of me. The idea that I have to specialize is a little bit odd.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't. I used to spend a lot of time in photographing wildlife, and I think you can see that in the book. But the whole wildlife photography arena became crowded, rather toxic, rather competitive, rather generic. So I think the chapters in the book that cover wildlife are maybe about one in five, whereas if you'd seen a book of mine from 10 years ago, it would have been five out of five.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the journey you go on as an artist.
Right. But you're also working with some wildlife conservation nonprofits and other organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll continue to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think our philanthropic endeavors have been more orientated towards pediatric cancer care recently. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons for that is there are politics involved in pediatric cancer care. Whereas in working in conservation, there is a lot of politics.
Right.
And you can give money to, I don't know, an NGO in Kenya, and you get people so angry saying, what are you doing giving money to it? It's corrupt. Don't ever give money to that area, you idiot. Or you can do the other way around and you get Kenyans saying that. So we got a little bit tired of how wokeism, if you like, or cancel culture has crept into the conservation area.
Mm-hmm.
But we still do work with some of the better organizations.
Yeah. So do you have plans for another book coming up, or are you still riding the wave from this last one?
I'm still paying for the last one.
Yeah. That's
I would imagine we might have one coming out in a couple of years' time.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm quite keen to do a book that's like our greatest hits type book.
Mm-hmm.
The back is a retrospective over the last 10 years. That's ideally what I'd like my next book to be.
Yeah, well, that would be beautiful. What else do you have coming up this year? You know, you have a lot of gallery openings and things like that, so...
Yeah, we have shows in about 10 cities between now and the end of the year. There's London, which is my hometown, so that's an important one. Berlin, Amsterdam, Dallas, Chicago, Johannesburg, and some new ones on the tour as well, which will be always interesting to go to new places. So lots to look forward to. And we will be doing a bit more filming in... As soon as it starts to snow, not in Florida, but starts to snow in other parts of America, we like to get our cameras back out again.
Mm-hmm. What is your favorite spot that you've shot in before?
What, in the world or in America?
Yeah, anywhere.
Very difficult. I mean, there are so many places we go back to. It's probably the places that you go back to the most are your favorites. It's a bit like when people ask you what your favorite film is. Mm-hmm. It should probably be the film you've watched the most number of times. Some people, when they're asked what their favorite film is, they want to be a little bit arty and talk about some independent Korean film that no one's heard of. I tend to, when I'm asked what my favorite films are, I'd probably say things like Jaws and Gladiator, and
right.
that I watched a lot of times, or Jerry Maguire. Many people say that. And with places, it's the same. It's the places I go back to the most, whether it be Montana, we go to a lot. We shoot in Iceland quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
We shoot in Alaska quite a bit. They tend to be kind of final frontier places. Norway we enjoy going to, and Switzerland, Namibia, Kenya a little bit, Texas, West Texas. And then some of your great cities.
Mm-hmm.
New York is always a great city to shoot in, Chicago. I haven't shot so much in the Middle East, and I haven't shot so much in Australia and New Zealand. I've visited there, but I haven't really focused my lens on those places so much.
Mm-hmm. So shooting in a place like Manhattan, like on Wall Street, for example, how do you even set that up? I mean, how do you have to block off the road, or how does that work?
You tend to work on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of times we close roads down would be on a Sunday. In where I am now, just off Sunset Boulevard, we've closed Sunset Boulevard down 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all between 7 and 8 on a Sunday morning.
Right. And then a lot of your shots are very like historic, kind of taking you back to the 70s all the way to the 1800s. How do you recreate those, moments in time in history?
Well, it's part, it's your job. I mean, it's not rocket science. You hire set dressers, you hire wardrobe people, you hire specialists, you have a team.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think any of it is intellectually that challenging. It sounds daunting, but it's not really. You just got to put in the hours, work with good people, and write the check. I know that sounds that.
No, it makes sense.
Maybe you're expecting to be say we have some sort of genius formula, but we don't. All we have is a bit of experience.
Mm-hmm.
I do think if you have a choice between doing a contemporary shoot, as in 2023, or doing something from 1923, I have a slight leaning towards 1923 mm-hmm. because it just adds a little bit of a more of a story.
Right. And then you've got the 70s sort of ski lodge series you said you were still working on a little bit. How's that going?
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever stop doing that. I mean, the glory days of places like Aspen and Samaritz were very much around that time when it was a little bit more bohemian,
mm-hmm.
liberal. It was the days where both those towns were peopled not necessarily by athletes, but by hedonists, and they live life to the full. Much better to tell a story about sex, drugs, and rock and roll than someone being a good skier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we have loved everything that we've seen and really loved having you in the magazine back in July. And we're just looking forward to whatever's coming next.
Well, who knows what's around the corner?
Yeah. just keep plugging along, keep working. And I want to ask you what I've been asking everyone on the podcast so far is, what is your favorite book?
My goodness. What is my favorite book? I enjoy books that are fact rather than fiction. And that's an insight into the lack of breadth in my character, because I should probably say Scott Fitzgerald or Hemingway or something like that. But I like to learn. I like autobiographies. I just finished reading Willie Nelson's book. Willie Nelson's a bit of a hero of mine. One book that I try to encourage my children to read, but it's a big book, is called The Prize. The Prize is won the Pulitzer Award way back in, I think, 1995. So it can't be bad if it won that award. And it's effectively the history of the oil industry since 1860. And there's enough in there for the scholar, but it's so character rich. There's so many different personalities that are brought into the book. It's 900 pages long.
Oh, wow.
But in many ways, the history of the oil industry and history of the world have been running hand in hand for the last 150 years. So it was a good read.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good one. I think we'll check it out. We'll add it to the list.
Good luck. For sure. It's quite heavy.
Okay. Good to know. So where are you headed next again?
We go to Denver tomorrow. We like Denver.
Okay.
It'll be a little bit cooler than Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Then we head to Johannesburg next week. That's a long flight. We don't really like that flight.
Yeah.
I think that's 17 hours. But
I'm headed to London on Saturday, but it's not that bad. So.
Well, the weather's going to be nice for you.
I think so, yeah. You enjoy all the traveling, or is it like exhausting?
No, it's fine. You just get used to it.
Yeah.
It's a good time to catch up and read and watch some movies you haven't seen. And the best thing about planes is that no one can get hold of you on your mobile phone.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for a while. I like that. For a while, anyway. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, David. If there's anything else that you'd like to let our readers know, or
I only say that we, at a time in America, has a lot of introspection about the divides in your country, that for us, it still is the country that gives creatives every opportunity. And I know Americans sometimes have self-doubt, but be in no doubt, it's still the best country in the world. And if you're a creative and you get America right, you don't need to worry about anything else.
Good to know. Great advice. Well, thank you so much for chatting with us today, and it was great to meet you.
Good to meet you too. Enjoy London.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.